Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to Episode 8 of Season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with the editors of the Ace Eddie-nominated documentary, American Symphony. Sammy Dane steps into the edit chair for the first time. His previous films include assistant editing on Aftershock, The Boy from Medellin, 16 Bars, and Hip Hop, The Songs That Shook America. Jim Heshen has cut Marina Amramovich, The Artist is Present, the TV series The Deep End, Philly DA, and David Blaine, The Magic Way. And Fernando Villegas has cut HBO Boxing, Golden, The Journey of USA's Elite Gymnast, and After Jackie. The film's director, Matthew Heineman, is also credited as an editor on the film. Before I hop into our discussion with Fernando, Jim, and Sammy, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Ace Eddie-nominated editors Sammy Dane, Jim Heshen, and Fernando Villegas. I'll have them introduce themselves so you can put a name with a voice.
My name is Jim Heshen. I'm an editor on American Symphony.
I'm Fernando Villegas, and I'm an editor on American Symphony.
I'm Sammy Dane. I'm an editor on American Symphony.
I don't know quite who wants to answer this question first, but my first question is always about the beginning of the film. Why do you choose to start on what you choose to start on? And in this film, it's John sitting at the riverside with his harmonium or whatever you call it, you know, his little keyboard. Why start it that way?
It's a really great question and interesting backstory, perhaps. That scene was actually the first day of shooting, and it was New Year's Eve. And it was Matt's first day with John. Matt Heineman is the director. It was, I believe, the first day that maybe they had met, but certainly that they had shot for the film. And Matt, kind of on my first day, Matt mentioned that, hey, take a look at New Year's Eve footage. It was the first, and he said, it was the first day me and John worked together. And I think he had a sneaking suspicion that there might be the beginning of the film there. So it was the beginning for all of us. It was the first day of shooting with Matt and John. It was my first day on the job in screening the footage. And it was New Year's Eve. So I screened that day and the day after and put together a long cut of that day, none of which ended up being in the actual film. I think with the exception of, I had flagged that that piano scene that begins the film as well. And that was from New Year's Eve. It was Matt's instinct, and it proved to be our opening scene. But it's interesting. My first relationship with the footage, John and Matt's first relationship with each other, and it was the beginning of a new year, and it started our beginning of our film.
You could sense it, though. You could sense that that was the beginning of something.
Well, my first pass, like to edit a version of him kind of singing at the river at, it was at dusk. So it was because it was dark out. And I felt like I was kind of gravitated to the moments and kind of just the ambiance of kind of the river at dusk there. But then Sammy took a whack at the same day from the same shoot, but it was daytime. And Sammy's cut actually is what starts the film.
That's a place that John, he needs to be there, especially at the end and the start of every year to kind of reflect on what's happened and think about where he's going. And I think the only difference in the two moments was that what he's playing on melodica there by the river is the symphony. It's the theme of the symphony. So the scene that Jim had cut, John is kind of singing Auld Lang Syne. And it's this very musing, amazing John, so spiritual, so energetic. But this was so focused on what he was about to do. And even though it might not come across immediately as, oh, this is the symphony, this is what he's working on, he starts to build that melody into the rhythm of the film, into the rhythm of the shoot. And it just felt so connected to everything that was going to come afterwards.
You guys reminded me that there's actually a scene before that, which is him at the piano.
It comes right after, yeah.
And that was the scene I was referencing before. That scene was from the same day. So that was the first day as well. And it was John at the piano kind of riffing and playing with musical themes. That also came from the same day.
Normally on a documentary, just because they go so long, there aren't so many people on. Were you guys under some kind of time constraint that they wanted three editors, or what was the idea there?
I think it was just the enormity of the footage. I mean, Matt captures everything. The cameras don't stop rolling. You cannot do it any service if it's just one mind. It has to be a collective sort of wisdom that starts to harness it. And Sammy was the first one on there where he was watching the dailies, everything. I think it would have driven a single editor insane to go through all that footage and start to quantify it and start to understand what the core of it was, you know?
Fernando, how much footage was it?
Over 1,400 hours.
Easily.
We had dailies that were 18 hours long. One daily could be like, oh, there's one scene in there, or there's three scenes in that daily. So in the beginnings, we were just cutting dailies and trying to find what were the powerful moments within that day. You needed three people because there were three vibrations within the film. You had his career, you had the symphony, and you had this life of his that he was going with Suleika. And I think that the wisdom of like the director, knowing that each one deserves a concentrated mind to find the real depth of it. I think that was very important for the film, for us to concentrate. And then Sammy organizing, I could never have done it. And I was brought on a little early too. I did the sizzle for it. I cut a few scenes in early on. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I've never seen this before. You know, I've never seen this intimacy before. I've never seen this vulnerability before. So it was like amazing. And then, you know, when Sammy started to organize it, it really allowed us to come to that point of like, okay, what are we doing here? What is this film becoming?
How did you divide responsibilities?
Well, Matt has a really interesting process and he always likes to work with multiple editors. He likes the hive mind. He likes the collaborative aspect, everyone bringing different ideas and taking on different scenes from different perspectives. But I was first tasked with watching all of the footage, which we kind of calculated how long it would have taken. It would have been about 10 months just to screen it, working hours.
I did the math on that's what I was typing, 1,400 divided by 40. So even if you just did 40, a 40-hour week is 35 weeks.
Yeah, which is a full edit in most docs. So I started 2 months into production and they ended up shooting for 7 months, almost every single day. So I was 2 months behind trying to piece together or understand editorially what was happening in the field. Every day, Matt would come back from the late show or he'd get back at very strange hours because they were filming for 16, 18 hours a day and just kind of tell me, oh, this happened. Or he would show me the footage of Suleika getting released from the hospital and we would just sit there and cry together. And Matt would wonder if he got the shot, if he was in focus or not. And so I was just trying to treat all of those hundreds of hours of footage as if they all had a place in the film. And if they did, how would they live in the film? And then kick out these 6 days to Jim, this week to Nando, and what are the scenes that are actually in here? And Jim and I had a conversation early on about a conversation he had with a mentor of his about the concept of nodal scenes. And so then I really tried to go into the Lex and say, what are the nodal scenes here? And wrote up a long document for everyone to think about and start to piece together these different storylines.
And Matt really has an instinct for it too. And you start working on the Suleika and John story arc. And for me, I mean, I love music. So I was like, oh man, I kind of want to get into the symphony. You know what I mean? But I'm so lucky and so blessed that was my task, you know, because it was like, I started being like, wow, there's something here. There's something really profound what's happening here with these two people, because you can feel like, do we share this or do we not? The opening up of their lives. I started gravitating early on to the fact that this is a love story. That direction is what actually made the film. Then we'll honor those aspects of these people's story.
Jim, what's that concept of nodal scenes?
It's actually a concept that I quite literally think about every day, certainly of my working life and maybe even in my off hours. The exact phrase came from Jonathan Oppenheim, who was a mentor of mine and who passed away relatively recently. He was a beautiful man and a brilliant man and a really seminal documentary editor for our craft and also for me in my development as an editor and just in my personal life as a human being. And effectively, John would say, there's a question when you're working on Verite films such as this, where you're going through hundreds of hours of footage, or in our case, thousands of hours of footage. And, you know, the obvious question, which is my fundamental question, is like, how do you decide of this real life unfolding in front of the camera? How do you decide what is in the film and what is not in the film? John simplified it with this idea of nodal scenes, which is like, of the hundreds of hours of footage or of the thousands of hours of footage, what are the five moments or what are the 10 moments, scenes that you witnessed in this sea of footage that are absolutely in the film? Hell or high water, what is without a doubt in this movie, because you know it in your gut, you know it instinctually, and you know it viscerally and emotionally. And it was really not academic and not quantifiable in language sometimes. And he would cut those scenes pretty viscerally and lay them all out and say, all right, maybe, you know, in some films you have, in my past experience, sometimes you have 4 nodal scenes. Sometimes you have 20 nodal scenes. You lay those all out and then you come up with some theory on what order they should appear. And then let's say you have 10 nodal scenes laid out, the telling the story, the creation of the story becomes pretty simple in the sense that you're just trying to get from one nodal scene to the next. So it's, all right, I got 5 minutes. I got to get this nodal scene to this nodal scene. And it makes it a little bit more manageable in your brain and kind of logistically as well, and kind of crafting a first pass of a story. And then you take a look at that. And then obviously there's iteration upon iteration upon iteration. But the idea of nodal scenes is like been my saving grace in basically every Verite film I've ever worked on, in the sense that I don't know how else to make sense of real life captured on camera for thousands and thousands of hours without that concept. So it's something that I think about every day. And I think about Jonathan every day. He simplified a very complex concept into a very digestible framework that I'm thankful for every day in my working life, for sure.
While we're on that subject, and Sammy, they're saying you did a lot of the organization, but what was your nodal scene?
Well, one of them that is in the cut is feels closest to what the first idea was when John is on tour and Suleika's back home in the hospital. And we're communicating their relationship and the distance just through these phone calls and FaceTime moments. That was such a tough scene to crack, because we wanted it to show John's dazzling, entertaining side, but also tether you to what he must have truly been thinking about and caring about during that moment. And it was so hard for him to be away from her, but he knew he had to, and he's providing for them at this moment when they need it the most. And the way that he was connecting with people in the audience was something that we had to strip for time, but the conversations that he would have with people afterwards, he was this figure who was touching people's lives in such a unique way. And I think that's represented in his Grammy speech and the way that music and art can just find you and grab you at the moment that you really need it. It was one of my favorite scenes to cut. And so much of that work had been done by Nando earlier in establishing their love and their connection and the trust that they had, so that John could go out on tour and do what he needs to do while Suleika is in the hospital doing what she needed to do.
What about you, Fernando? A nodal scene for you. You must have had a lot of them if you were doing that kind of love story.
I think for me, one of the ones that resonates the most is when they're in the hospital, where he's using music as medicine for her. And that scene of them getting up to stretch and walk around and they play Simon Says. It's like to find that happiness in those kind of moments spoke volumes to me. It's like, you know, no matter how much darkness we're facing right now, it matters how we face it. That's medicine. To find, you know, these moments of hope and moments of terror. These kind of scenes need to make the film. Because that's what connects us to a broader audience. And to also like signify that it's the music, it's the certain kind of music that we can give to the world that can be used as medicine for those that need it when they need it most. So for me, like, you know, putting on the Lean on Me, you know what I mean? All that stuff. I loved cutting that scene, especially because I cut a lot of other stuff where it was like, oh my God, this is heavy. This is dark. Yeah, that was one of the most notable scenes to me.
The scene that Netflix has allowed us to play and kind of talk about is from the hospital where they kind of dance down the hallway.
I feel a strong, strong desire to take the pain away. But I can't. This is a moment, a test. And it's nobody's fault and nobody can control it.
Can you talk about constructing that and even deciding, I mean, obviously it's a great scene, but deciding that that was going to be one of the scenes that makes the film?
Exactly for that reason. That scene really played upon the duality of what they were experiencing, bridging those two contrasts of going through something that's going to be very scary and hard for a young couple to be going through. And, you know, this is almost immediately after their marriage, to find the playfulness in that moment, to find the hope in that moment. We all put hands on all aspects of the film as it started going on. But to me, when I started cutting that, it was like a 10-minute scene. And I was like, oh, I don't want any of this to go away. You know what I mean? It's like, and then you start shrinking. But no matter what, we knew that moment where it was like, although a lot of the film is John's over here living this other life while his wife's over here living this life. It was those moments that brought them together. And we could see how two people can go through this happening in their life. And also what's really beautiful is the wedding was before the hospital. And it really, you know, resonated with the vow through sickness and in health. Those things are real. You know, it resonated because especially now in these days, our values, you know, need to be reinforced. And for them to show us that we can go through these things with hope and joy and playfulness was powerful.
What's the process between the three of you and the director to determine how long that scene would be if it starts at 10 minutes? A great 10-minute scene. Like you said, I didn't want to cut any of it, but like I know. But I felt like I had a good amount of, when I was watching the movie, I felt, as an audience member, that's the right length, you know, but
yeah, of course,
but 10 minutes.
We fall in love with it, but then ultimately reality sets in and discipline. Matt is perfect at that. It's like to have the discipline to allow yourself to let go of those things for the benefit of the film. You start chipping away at this piece of granite, you know, to sculpt that scene. And it's that discipline. Okay, I can lose that. I can lose that. And then knowing there's no more to be cut from it, you know? And that took a collective wisdom, you know? That took everybody putting their hands on that scene. Because there are moments where me, as the person that cut that 10-minute scene, you're starting to wreck my soul here. Someone take it and be the assassin. But that's discipline, you know? And that's, I think, the greatness of working with a team. It was very helpful.
So many times when we're cutting these scenes initially, like, you know, Nando will discover a scene, let's the walking down the hallway scene, or Sammy will discover a scene, or I'll discover a scene. A lot of times, at the time that we're discovering the scene, we have no idea what the film is yet. And neither does Matt, and neither does any of us. Perhaps the more responsible thing is to cut the scene to be 10 minutes, because you don't know what the hell the movie is yet, or what's going to be useful and what's going to serve what in relation to how scenes will speak to each other and you know, the structure of the story, et cetera, et cetera. So I think my fault a lot of times, if I had to be self-critical, is I cut scenes a little too tight at the beginning when I first come across them, because I kind of want to make, I want to make the movie. You know, it's always a struggle with myself and my teammates sometimes where I got to cut things a little looser. You know, I'd be more Nando in the sense that I got to cut a 10-minute scene as opposed to cut a 2-minute scene right off the bat. You got to cut for the film at the spot that it's at the given point in time and not for our advanced knowledge of what it is.
So I'm assuming that that was early on for all of you. It was about creating those verite scenes and not worrying too much about the structure of the final film.
God bless Matt. Just I really want to stress this, and the whole team, Joe Dan and Lauren, and the whole how they structure the edit itself, because there's a real discovery process that happened on this film, and it was only possible given the amount of time that was allowed for in the edit to discover things and to fail and to succeed. Without that period of experimentation and discovery, the film wouldn't be what it ended up being.
Absolutely. I mean, it was an 18-month edit process. It's about twice as long as most, I think. And it was kind of divided into these three sections. So the first 6 months was dailies, selects, scenes, moments, feelings. The second, once Lauren Domino, our incredible producer, came on and she started screening everything, we had already kind of started to develop this global knowledge of where things were headed. And so she was able to look at it from a structural standpoint. And so she and Matt and Joe Dan were this kind of brain trust thinking about what are the main storylines, where will they possibly intersect? But originally we just cut these storylines as their own films. So John's career arc, John and Suleika's love story, John's residency at Carnegie Hall and the symphony. And they were really thinking all the time about how are these scenes speaking to each other? Where do we need to go into this world and out of that world?
Yeah, we essentially cut three movies. You know, like our initial rough cut was like 8 hours long, right?
Yeah, 6 hours, 40 minutes.
It could have been 12.
It could have been 12.
Probably could have been 1,400.
Right. I know, right? Exactly. Oh my God. Exactly. There is a double-edged sword with a wealth of riches. When you have that many options, it becomes extremely difficult. If you don't have enough meat on the bones, then you can be creative. We can pull out all the tricks to expand. But this was like, holy shit, man. Like, there's an abundance here that was exciting, but daunting. To tear that down, like to rein that in, was possibly the most difficult thing I've ever done editorially.
On New Year's Eve, John and Suleika are hanging out. Just, it's not a big New Year's Eve craziness. It's just the two of them on a couch, basically. Right at the end of that, she takes some pills. And I thought that was a very interesting, because as an audience member, you don't know what's to come, but that's a little bit of foreshadowing. Was that the thought there, that let's let the audience know something's going on?
I give credit to Matt for that one. I was really hard on that scene, and for a long time, to the point where I kind of felt bad, where like every screening we had for a couple months, I was like, prior to that edit, there was that beautiful scene on the couch. And there was this beautiful scene on the bed with the two of them. And it was intimate and it was meaningful to all of us, which is why it was in that film. But my reaction to it was, you're always looking for a scene to progress from kind of A to B. Something happened. It doesn't have to be huge, but something has to kind of evolve within the scene. And for the longest time, those two scenes just were kind of floating a little bit. And I wasn't quite sure where they were going. And they were kind of placed at the top of the film. And Matt, to his credit, really hung on to those two scenes because I think he thought they belonged there, but we hadn't as a team kind of cracked how to get them to play kind of narratively and cinematically. And one day Matt inserted the pill scene that I hadn't seen screen the footage. I didn't know it existed. I'll pat myself on the back. I approved it immediately. I said, that's it. I saw it. I was like, immediately my half year long incessant annoyance with kind of how we were structuring that would like dissolve in a second with that one shot. Everything came together immediately.
It's amazing because we were struggling with that, and then it's amazing how one shot,
yeah,
one moment can do that.
Yeah, we tried so many different things with that, and that moment in the bedroom, we tried all these different versions where someone had sent Suleika a basketball with all these signatures from friends of hers saying, kick cancer's butt, you're going to win, keep fighting, all this stuff. And John was reading it and like palming the basketball and trying to help her to palm the ball too. And we loved it, but it was too much. And we wanted to just do these little samples of her story and drop it out in installments. So the next time you hear about it was when they're having the snowball fight. And she says, no one can hit me with snowballs. I have leukemia. And I think something that Matt really strives to do, and this achieved that in a really interesting way, was he always wants the edit to feel the way he felt in the room capturing the moment. And I think for that moment with the pillbox, it was their first day of filming. There was so much uncertainty ahead, and Matt was still trying to build trust with them. He wasn't necessarily going to ask for all this access immediately. So to just be allowed to see a moment like that of her taking these pills, and she had this entire bag of pills that she had to take for chemo, and to be let into their world like that so intimately, so immediately, it was like just the right amount.
What we're really talking about, I think, too, is foreshadowing. If you want to get kind of into the wonky storytelling aspect of it all. But on a human level, I think we really wanted to let Zuleika exist in the story without her illness. Let her exist as a character not burdened by the illness and as a human being before we embarked on the story of her cancer. So that was that little subtle shot. The reason why I kind of initially reacted to it the way I did was it served a storytelling purpose where you're foreshadowing something. You're not revealing to the audience right off the bat what is going on in her life. You're letting them know that something is, but you're simultaneously kind of letting Zuleika be a human who's not yet burdened by her illness. So in other words, she gets to exist in the film in a way that is not attached to her condition.
I appreciated the fact that you gave the audience a lot of credit in tracking the story, because she's not introduced, her disease is not introduced. Their relationship is obvious because they're cuddling on a couch, but you don't really, you're like, the audience will figure this stuff out.
I think we do underestimate audience a lot, especially in a lot of the expressions I've seen out here with documentary filmmaking. Context is a slippery slope. There are things you feel you don't need to be told. And if you have the courage to allow that, that's where artistry lives. And it resonates more so than someone telling you how to feel. The amount of time that we were allowed, which was a gift to spend with it, is why it is what it is and why it resonates the way it does. Because you can find those ways of connecting with just an image, and people feel that. We know you'll get it because we get it.
Exactly.
It's like we're all humans.
Amen to that, man. We've all evolved for thousands and thousands of years to, you know, read expressions. Or be sympathetic human beings. And, you know, so if I'm responding to something on a visceral level in the screening of the footage, the more and more I do this, the more and more I trust that the audience will as well. But, you know, it's like, I'm not special. I feel like our job as documentary editors working in birthday footage is, if we have a skill, it's to be cognizant or be aware of our visceral emotions and our visceral reaction to the footage. So it's like, it's just noting the moments. Like, if I react to that, you have to trust that other human beings will likely react in a similar way that I did by virtue of the fact that we're all human beings.
Our commonality is what allows you to edit those scenes together.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can somebody talk to me about the montage that's built around the Zoom call that John has about the symphony, kind of like meeting all the people that are going to be part of the symphony?
Yeah, that one was so interesting because the initial conceit of the film was process film, John creating the symphony and really traveling the country to find the perfect musicians to make his vision come to life. And as they say, then life intervened and they had to change course. So that 2-minute montage was kind of the remnant of the first idea. And it was all centered around this one vocal performance from this group of siblings. They're a group called Infinity Song, and it's the Boyd siblings. Just these amazing singers who John gave them an idea of what he wanted the piece to represent. And they created this one verse, you know, dawn day to dusk, the night it comes for us, but we shall overcome. And lyrically, that was supposed to encapsulate the entire vision for the piece. And so we just started intercutting it with John scouting. So he was in North Dakota working with indigenous musicians, and he's in the studio working on his own project, and he's doing some crazy project with like 30 musicians for Disney. And so all these different influences that are going on in John's mind come together and get in the pot and become American Symphony. The Zoom call is also John talking to what was at that point the entire symphony orchestra and trying to explain to them the vision and the process. And he's referencing Duke Ellington and Coltrane and talking about how this process is going to be different. And so I think Jim and I both took a crack at bringing that, you know, his monologue, his thesis down. But there were so many parts of that that were so interesting. And we just had to be disciplined. It goes back to discipline. What are the three sentences that distill this in this epic vision down? And then how can we pair that with imagery that elicits all the emotions that the piece is hopefully going to elicit in Carnegie Hall?
It's the biggest struggle in verite nonfiction editing to sometimes provide context for what's happening. And really what I'm looking for is in the kind of storytelling language or kind of wonky cinematic languages is the inciting incident. What sparks John to want to make the American Symphony? The answer to that dates back to John's upbringing and John's training as a musician. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the culmination of his entire kind of personal life and his career. In the documentary, we didn't film all that, obviously, right? So you're walking in into a moment where John, you know, in some ways had already decided to make American Symphony. You're trying to convey to the audience, why is John making the American Symphony? What led him to that? Which happened off camera. A real challenge is always to kind of fulfill that need in the story for the inciting incident. In this case, why is John making the symphony? The real answer to that was not captured by us. So I think that scene was a moment where we really had to kind of work with what we had in real life and in the footage to give an answer to that in a way. And we kicked that back and forth. There was a million iterations. I don't remember who did what or like, you know, I mean, it was a combination between all like the three of us and Matt and a million notes from other folks who were kind enough to weigh in. So it's that scene was pivotal and hence went through and tricky and hence went through a million different cuts.
Especially because we did not do the interviews in a traditional way. We didn't like have master interviews. We didn't have like this people helping us to move the story along. We were literally pulling narrative from moments that happened months apart. And to have that in your lexicon, to construct the core of that narrative, it wasn't like, oh, it's a soundbite from an interview. It's like, no, it's a construct of this thing happening through months. And then to condense that down to a scene, for me, it's a miracle it even happened. That we didn't say like, oh my God, let's go shoot an interview now. You know what I mean? To help us. But that's what makes it beautiful. Let's put in the heavy work to find the reality in the moment to construct the narrative.
To be able to have a memory of 1,400 hours or 1,500 hours or 2,000 hours of footage and go, oh, he says something when he goes to that studio in Omaha, that sentence would work over here.
This is where the teamwork and part of being a nonfiction editor on this sort of project, you simultaneously have to be a really great teammate and be open to everyone and everyone's thoughts and everyone's memories. Like they're quite literally would have been impossible for one single editor or person to have cut this film. So I think all of us leaned on each other's and our collective knowledge and our collective hard work to not only, you know, just put in the work to watch the footage, but also to record our memories of the footage. And that's not just the three of us. That includes Matt, that includes Lauren, that includes Godin, our producers, that includes Tony Hardman and Thor, our cinematographers, because they're taking notes as they shoot and kind of recording. The editing of this sort of film, it requires the teamwork of the wonderful people who were included in making this film. And it also includes Joe DeGrand, our assistant editor, who was a wealth of knowledge of just what happened in the footage, what transpired. The editing of a film like this, given the realities, like requires a mass of people and a mass of kind of really thoughtful, wonderful people. We're really blessed to all have worked with each other and know each other.
I want to give you guys a chance to just hug.
we have hug in person. I have not met either one of these guys in the flesh.
I've not met Jim in real life. I want to hug him right now.
I know. We really need that.
It's so crazy, isn't it?
The three of you have never been in the same room together?
No.
No, me and Sammy, we live in New York. So you know, I've worked a lot out of my little troll cave here, you know, as an editor, but I would make it to the office a bunch just to be re-inspired. But that was the beauty of this film. Every person inspired you to really want to focus and say, what are we doing here? You know, what are we saying? And where is the medicine? Where is the medicine that we can put into this film? It was a beautiful experience and it was rare. And I'm so blessed to have experienced it with these minds that I did. I learned a great deal.
Fernando, can you explain what you mean by put the medicine into this film?
Early on, I understood what it is that we do with storytelling. It's a double-edged sword. It can either create or destroy. We can uplift the human condition with the stories that we tell. And that's by injecting medicine into it. And the medicine is the acknowledgement that we are all in this together. We are all experiencing this together. And we're not alone. And if we shine a light upon the darkness with this story, then we can subside the fear that creates a division between us all. And that to me is my North Light in everything I put my work into. It's like, how can I put a word or an image in there to help someone understand that you are not alone and we are with you? That's medicine. Thank God for my father, who adopted me from the streets of Philadelphia, taught me that it's the stories we tell that make us who we are. And there are forces out there that want to tell us a different story, that want to take our power. So always involve yourself in the stories that give us power, that re-empower us. That's the medicine.
Amen. I love that. The next scene I wanted to talk about is, I think, one of those medicine scenes, which is the sledding scene. Why is that in the film? I think it should be. Like, if I was a part of the editing team, I would say, hey, the sledding scene's got to be in there. But why did it make it in the film, especially as it leads into the Salaika scene?
That was one of the earliest scenes I cut, which was, again, a 10-minute, 15-minute scene. But it was such a great moment of them two, again, being, you know, this young couple, you know, experiencing new things together. As Jim said, how do we get into Salaika and her illness without us just hammering you in that she's this thick woman now? We needed to give her a life. And that was, I think, a great way of doing it by, you know, introducing like, okay, they're experiencing this moment in the snow. But at the same time, she then lets us know like, hey, I have leukemia. And that was a great place to do it. Because I think in the beginning of the film, they weren't sure whether or not they were wanting to share that with Matt. It slowly started to happen. That's why it had to make the film. It's like, that's when it really started to come out that, you know, and we can slowly introduce this idea of what's happening in their lives without it, you know, being this hammer, you know, like, boom, you know, she's sick. It's like, it was a beautiful moment where they were free, healthy, alive, but yet knowing that the storm was coming.
Let's talk a little bit about intercutting, because there's a nice moment where John is working on kind of testing out the symphony and you're intercutting it with the painting in the hospital. Just talk about why intercut those. Why aren't they separate scenes? And how do you take maybe what's one person's work with Salaika and the other person's work with the symphony?
We go through so many iterations of these cuts and so many passes and so many experiments that we probably intercut it at some point. But I do think that we go from the first symphony to the hospital to her painting, but the music continues. I'm pretty sure that's what ultimately is in the film.
Yeah, the music carries through all throughout that introduction to her painting, yeah.
Both those scenes, Zuleika in the hospital and John at his first rehearsal, come at the beginning of Act Two. Our main characters are embarking on their journey. They've kind of left the normal, ordinary world of their previous life, and now they're both embarking on their quest or their journey, which in our cases, you know, John's journey would be to create the symphony, Zuleika's journey would be to enter chemotherapy and beat cancer. So at that moment in the film, it was really important to all of us, certainly important to Matt, certainly important to me and Jordan and Lauren, somehow at that kind of stage of our story, create a really stark declaration of both of their individual journeys, and then also connect the two of them, which would be their art. So John is creating his art in the American Symphony rehearsal, and then to go to Zuleika in the hospital, but leaning on her creative works and her self-expression. So it becomes a story of they're both embarking on their individual journeys, but together they're both leaning on, for lack of a better word, artistic endeavors to get them through the challenges that have presented them in their personal lives, both as a couple and as individuals. How to do that, there's probably a million different ways. What we arrived at, what I think, was kind of just smashing them together and then tying it together with the music was a way to kind of present their individual journeys while simultaneously joining them as lovers and as a couple.
One of the other thing I want to talk about is transitions, the difficulty of doing them. And the one that I can think of, you can talk about any ones you want, transitioning between the touring montage of John out on tour, and then at some point he comes back to the symphony. So let's talk about transitions between some of these verite sections or some of the tonal sections.
That one in particular was so hard to make work, because that first performance, when he dedicates a song to Zuleika, that entire performance was improvised piano. He started the show by telling the audience this music has never been played before and it will never be played again. And so finding the way to incorporate that performance into the film was beautiful, and it was a nightmare at times. And I think Nando really took to it as score throughout the whole first act and so beautifully incorporated it into those moments where we're getting to know them. And so this is like right at the halfway point of the film, but it's kind of the culmination of their connection at that moment. We have a 95 second moment of silence before he goes into this unbelievable moment and just letting everything out there. And Zuleika's parents are in the audience. He was wearing her hospital bracelet as a source of strength and a source of connection between them, as he quite literally tried to heal her through this music. And coming off of the tour, and you've heard about her ups and downs in the hospital and how hard it's been when she had to be away from John, but finding that rhythm of letting that moment play was really tough. And it was something that I didn't quite have the gall to do, to pitch to Matt, let's just sit in this moment. So I took so many different cracks at trying to cut that moment down. And then one day in the edit, Matt and I were sitting there and Matt was like, let's just roll this out. What's on the head of this? What's on the tail of that? And just let this moment play. And I think getting to collaborate individually with your director sometimes is the key, because you might think something is too audacious to try on your own and pitch to your director, but when they're sitting there with you, you just have the freedom to try anything. And that's how that moment really became so pivotal.
Yeah, that was actually one of my notes after that, which was there is a huge pause before the dedicated song to Zuleika. And it's a very emotional moment. I mean, that is a powerful moment, but it's also one, as an editor, you're like, how long are they going to let this go on? Because he says, I'm going to dedicate this song, and his hands are on the piano, and you know the audience is listening, and he's just sitting there. It's very powerful.
It's the middle of the film. It's the midpoint. And in an action film, that's where you may have the big fight scene or a car chase. And in verite film, the equivalent of that, ironically, might be a long pause. Its placement in the film deserves attention. And one way to call attention to that scene, I think, is exactly what we're all talking about, is that long pause. I think collectively as a team, and Matt's included in that, and Lauren's included that, and Jordan's included in that, where that scene landed and the way that we presented it and cut it, or didn't cut it in this case, was a wise choice. And it's tied to where it is in the movie. You place that scene in another point in the movie and it may not resonate in the way it does.
It was definitely perfect to allow you to absorb all that you had witnessed thus
mm-hmm.
far.
Mm-hmm.
The gravity of all that's happening, you feel it with him, you know, like he just went through this turbulent experience of, you know, touring, meanwhile being there while his wife was going through this incredible, painful experience, you know, and it allows us all to take a breath, you know, and feel the gravity of what's really happening in their lives.
Yeah, the audience has been able to see how important the moment is because of all that's gone before it. Yeah, I love that. Let's talk about how long something like the piece of music that John plays for Zuleika can be. That piece was in person, a 15-minute song, which you obviously can't use all of, but how long can or should it be? How short can it be?
Yeah, and there's some phantom edits in there that Jim pretty masterfully hid through camera work and sound editing. It was a 15-minute song, so we got it down to like 6.
It's a great question. And you know, I've worked on a couple films about artists. You want to present their art in a fair way. Particularly with music, it gets really tricky because when you make an edit in a live performance that John Batiste is playing, you're changing his art in a way that wasn't meant to originally be heard. So I think the approach that I took to that musical moment, that moment of hope, was to do my best to not be seen. I was just trying to cut the song in a way where it got it down to a digestible length for the context of our film, but also didn't disrupt what my interpretation of the essence of the performance was. And that's a tricky dance. And, you know, I don't think you ever get it 100%, but I think the attempt there was to just cut it in a way that didn't mess it up. And that includes the camera work. There was a real connection between John expressing himself into the piano and then our camera work responding to John and the music. And I felt like I was on the, like when I was trying to re-edit that song, I was on the receiving end of a lot of creative energy on that. And I was just trying to like receive it and not mess it up, for lack of a better word.
I've got one more question, which I hope will tie in everybody. There's a section of the symphony where the power goes out on stage. And it's kind of a disaster. And you choose to go into a series of flashbacks at that moment. So talk about why flashbacks then. How do you take the contributions of multiple people? You know, the love story is in there and all these other things are in there. Talk about that montage between the three of you and the collaboration of that.
Matt knew that early on. He made that note early on. Like, I feel like, let's play with that. You know, let's play with recollection. Here we are now, and let's like recall what it took us to get here. It was in different places before. And like I said, the collective wisdom has to come in. And that was like an hour and a half concert, you know, that we cracked down to like, what was it, 13 minutes, 10 minutes, 15, 12 minutes without losing the thesis of what he was trying to express. I just think Matt already knew. It's like a perfect place for us to not just be immersed in the music, but to understand what all it took for that moment to happen.
But you said that was in other places in the film. You had moved that.
No, it was in other places within the concert. Ultimately, it's like, no, that's where it belongs. You know, like it was more towards the end at some in an earlier cut. And then Jim edited that beautifully. That was a great way of honoring their journey and saying this stuff does not come from just the moment. It takes everything that's happening to us, our life experience, to create this artistry.
It's so funny, man. It's like how like other people's ideas kind of motivate me. The idea to intercut moments from the film into the symphony performance itself, that was floating around for a long time. And that seemed like a bold move in a challenging way, in the sense that I kept saying, like, if we're going to do that, we got to earn that. You're doubling down on your entire film. It's like sitting at the poker table going all in. You know, my instincts are like, let's go all in. But my kind of self-motivation was like, all right, if we're going to do that at the end, the previous 85 minutes have to be banging. But it was like a driving force for me pretty early on, because that idea was floating around for a long time. Let's say for a year. I was like, if we're gonna do that, we got out for a game like in every scene prior to it. And I you know, the hope is that we did it.
I think you definitely did it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. I just loved American Symphony, and you guys did a masterful job.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for all you do, Steve.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Sammy Dane, Jim Hessian, and Fernando Villegas for joining us on Art of the Cut to discuss the Ace Eddie-nominated documentary, American Symphony. And thanks to our partner, Boris Effects, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop, Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @Steve Hallfish. See you there.